After living with the horrific memories of a flight from the Russian army at the end of the Second World War, for almost 50 years, Helga Gerhardy put pen to paper for what became the first part of her acclaimed autobiography.
Now, just 2 years on, she's just published the second part of her incredible story, and she joined us in the studio this morning. Helga Gerhardy, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
It's not an understatement to say that your story is an incredible one. Could you, I mean, I know it's probably hard, but could you briefly just tell us about the early years and how you came to be in Britain?
My early years were spent in East Prussia, which is near the Lithuanian border, and I lived under Hitler, went to school, but when the war broke out and gradually the Russians moved into East Prussia, we started to get very, very worried because we've heard the different stories about how they treated the civilian population. And I decided when it was time that I ought to leave. I was a medical student at the time, looking after wounded soldiers coming back from the front. But they warned us, particularly young nurses, about the treatment we would receive when the Russians arrived. So I became a refugee. It was very unfortunate at that particular moment. My whole family was absolutely scattered. Everybody seemed to be somewhere else. So I was on my own. And I did this terrible trip in 1944-45 in 10 to 15 degrees below zero, walking over frozen lands, frozen lakes, with the Russians shooting at us. But I got away, although it was very, very bad because we had no food, we had no shelter. It was a long trip. But eventually I did find my mother. I even found my father. We all found ourselves together again and returned to Switzerland because we felt it was a country which had not been occupied by any enemies during the last war, being neutral, and we made a new start.
Now, I get the impression in the early chapter of the book that you were a very close family. There's a couple of stories about, I believe you were a middle child.
Yes, I was the second in a second daughter.
I read about that the youngest children were spoilt and maybe the eldest were felt very proud, but you sort of felt a little lost in the middle. Is that true?
I think I always went my own way. I did a lot of sport. My elder sister was pretending, I think, always to sort of be ill or something, so she didn't have to do any jobs at home. My younger sister was delicate. She was very fair, very blonde. And of course, my brother was 4 years younger, and he was spoiled because he was the last one to arrive and the only boy.
You were a bit accident prone, weren't you, Helga? Something happened to you. Was it your small sister? She was struck dumb.
Yes, well, this happened because she fell out of the window.
There's an interesting story as to why that happened. Tell us that.
Well, we used to play upstairs on the second floor, you know, sort of jump about, and she wanted to climb on my back, and I used to sort of carry her across the room. So she did. And I did that once or twice, and then suddenly I said, now come on my back. She was sort of on the window shelf, and she didn't climb onto my back. And when I turned round, I'm afraid the window was wide open, and she had fallen out of the window. Yeah. Now, this was from the second floor. So I quickly ran downstairs to see what had happened to her. She was badly hurt, but what had happened is her dress got caught on one of the sort of sticking out pipes, which prevented her to have not such a bad fall. And then at the bottom was a sand heap. She fell on that and sort of rolled onto stones. She had her head was wounded. She was bleeding, and after that, she was she wouldn't talk anymore. But I think that was the shock. The doctor did say that eventually she would get her speech back again, and of course she did. But this was because I was naughty. We went for a walk one day with my mother and my brother and other sister, and she was sort of in a pram, and I met a very big dog, a St. Bernard dog, and he was a lovely dog. And I always used to go back to my sister Crystal because she couldn't talk and I wanted to help her. And I said, come on then. I said to this dog, you know, you must come and meet my sister. And I sort of pulled him along, and he did come. And my sister was petrified when she saw this dog. And she said, no. And nobody took any notice of it, but she had said no. And this was the first time she spoke, and my mother got cross because she said, how can you bring this big dog? And all I could say was, Crystal said no, she can speak again. And
so that got you out of trouble?
Yes, yes.
That was 9 months after the accident, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. She didn't talk for 9 months, but after that she sort of caught up again and she was soon able to speak.
Did you feel responsible for the injury?
In a way, I did, because indirectly, I think my parents blamed me, although, I was only young, I didn't realise that this window might open and she could fall out, but when she was so hurt and bandaged up, she was laying on a settee, and my father did point to her and said to me, that is your fault. And, you know, for a long time after that, I used to keep on thinking about it and always saying to myself, but it wasn't. I loved her and I wouldn't have wanted her to fall out of the window.
You were talking about the problems caused by the Red Army, but you actually met Adolf Hitler, didn't you?
Yes, I did meet Adolf Hitler, but that's a little story in my first book. And
we want to hear it.
Oh, all right. Well, it was an accident. I wasn't in the Hitler Youth because I was Swiss. And on that particular day, I went to my piano lesson in a town, and I knew Hitler was coming, and the roads were full of people, and the Hitler Youth used to stand by the pavement, keeping the people back. Mm. But my father only would come home for weekends, so there was a lady selling some flowers, and I bought a little bunch of flowers. And I knew I had to cross the road, and I kept on looking and wondering whether I could dare cross the road before Hitler came, because it was really closed. But I squeezed through the people and jumped in the road, and I was going to go across when his cavalcade came around the corner. Mm. Because I was absolutely petrified. So I stood there. Of course, I had this little bunch of flowers in my hand. And one of the SS men jumped the car, and he came towards me, and he said, you can give these flowers to the Führer. So I said, well, they're really for my father. But I only sort of whispered, because I was terribly frightened, you see. And he pulled me along and to Hitler, and he bent down, and he took my flowers, and he had cold blue eyes. I sort of shivered. And then he looked at me and he said, you are not in uniform. Because, you see, I didn't belong to Hitler Youth. I said, no, I'm Swiss. But I don't know whether he heard it, because all the people were screaming and shouting, and they were all shouting Heil Hitler. And I was glad to get away from him. The SS man said, now you can run off, and of course I crossed the road. But when I told my father about it, he was cross, because he felt if that got into the paper, a Swiss girl giving flowers to Hitler wasn't exactly the thing he liked. But I must say, it didn't come in the paper.
He wasn't a supporter of Hitler, your dad? Your father wasn't a supporter of Hitler?
No, I'm afraid he wasn't.
The divisions in the country started quite early, though. I read one story in the book about your friendship with a young Romany gypsy girl that you had to stop. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, well,
I mean, that sort of was the forerunner to something a bit more sinister, I suppose.
Yes, well, we were, when I went to school, I just changed my school to this particular one, and children are funny. When they know you are the same, then they play with you, but if they know you're not the same, they sort of seem to separate you a little bit. Well, the trouble was, I had learned to write printing in my other school, and in this school we had to do what was called Zutterlinschrift, and I wasn't very good at it. And there was a gypsy girl in the class, and of course she was hopeless, because the trouble with her was her parents travelled a lot, and she only had a short time in one school and a short time in another school. So the two of us, because we weren't very good, we made friends. And I got better, but she didn't get better. And then one day she gave me a great big marble. She said, you know, this was something I would have to put in my pocket, because her grandmother, who could read the fortune of people, you know, had put a spell on it. And if I kept that in my pocket, this would be all right, you know, and I'd only had to touch it and I would be fine in any spelling test. And I was. I just couldn't make it out. I touched this marble, and then we had a spelling test. I never made a mistake. That was it.
Then you ought to bring it in for our producer. He's a terrible speller.
Well, I wanted to give it to her, but she said, no, it was only a spell on it for me, so it wouldn't work for anybody else. So I'm afraid it won't work for your producer.
Tell us the story of how you actually came to be in East Prussia.
Well, it was my grandfather who already emigrated from Switzerland, and he...
What, why did he do that?
Well, he was very good in making cheeses and butter. And, of course, in Switzerland, I'm afraid, too many people make cheese and butter. So he emigrated to a little town called Tilsit by the River Memel. It's actually quite a famous town because, in his, you know, it's got a lot of history. But anyway, he tried to make the Swiss cheese, but he wanted to do it in a shorter time and also a smaller size cheese. So it became a different cheese. And he won the gold medal at the Leipzig Food Fair, and he called it Tilsiter cheese. And I must say, even today, you can still buy occasionally this Tilsiter cheese. And all it is that it is has the name of the town where my grandfather had opened up his dairy. And of course, my father took over. And then we moved from Tilsit to a bigger town, to Königsberg, the capital of East Prussia, because my mother felt we were four children, and she said it was better to move to a bigger town from the education point of view than a small one. And that's where I grew up. But I never realized that I was different, you know, until Hitler came to power, because my father didn't go and vote. That was one of the reasons why I suddenly became different. At first, they called me a communist, because only the communists didn't go and vote, you see. But then I started to notice things, too, because we had I had a Jewish friend in class, and she said she didn't come to school one day. So I thought I couldn't find out what happened to her. And that was terrible, because they had a draper's shop and lived above the draper's shop. When I got there, it was very eerie, actually. There was nobody in the road, and the draper's shop was all broken. All the windows were broken. And all the material was laying in the road, hats and gloves and handkerchiefs and even the shop upstairs.
I can't imagine, actually, what it must be like to sit in a classroom and watch your school friends disappear almost one by one, day after day.
Well, it wasn't as bad as that, because we only had two Jewish people in my class. There were some in the other classes, probably. But in East Prussia, you didn't have too many Jewish people. They were more in the main part of Germany. And these two, of course, disappeared. But otherwise, everybody went into the Hitler Youth at the age of 10. I didn't go, so of course, I was lonely at times. I sort of felt I didn't understand a lot about politics. You don't, as a child. You want to do what your friends are doing. Mm-hmm. And I joined once or twice their meetings. I didn't think they were all that harmful, except that they had to learn all the curriculum vitae of Hitler, Goering, Goebbels, Himmler. But otherwise... might be boring, but...
What was the attraction? What was the attraction of Hitler to them?
He was portrayed as the saviour of the nation. After the First World War, a lot of land was taken away from Germany, and he promised to get that back. And the young boys already were believing that, and they adored him. They absolutely adored Hitler. And it was when the war broke out, they died for him, because they were taught that at an early age. Already from 10 years old, he was portrayed as a father figure, as the man who loves children, who loves the country, who loves the world. He will make Germany great. And you could see that in the children. They did anything for him. At 17 and 18, they went already into the war and died for him. I mean, I've had boyfriends. They all got killed, one after another one, at the Russian front.
When did their belief in Hitler start to falter?
I think when the war started to go wrong. That was after the Battle of Stalingrad, when the Russians gradually started to push back. Mm. And then, of course, the Normandy landings from the other side, from the west side, you see. That's when Germany got crushed, I think. When Hitler removed the generals and just said, I'm the top general, I'm going to lead you all, that's when the army started to feel this isn't right anymore. And when the civilian population suffered more and more, all the bombing, the same as they had it in London, we had it in Germany where we lived, people died right, left and centre. Refugees started to come, like I said, in East Prussia, where I started to have to leave. You see, in the West, people never left. They waited for the English and Americans to come, mm-hmm. because that was fine. You could keep your home. They were treating you decently. But I'm sorry to say, the Russians, to them, life didn't matter.
There Some people would say, well, you can understand it. I mean, they suffered terribly, didn't they?
Yes, they did suffer very badly. The Germans treated them very badly, and of course, they didn't recognize that they would do the same thing to them. But all the people from the East and myself, we all lost everything. I mean, when we returned to Switzerland, we had nothing. Nothing at all, only the clothes, not even the clothes on our bodies, because that was given to us by the Swiss Embassy.
But moving slightly forward from obviously what was a quite distressing time, Switzerland did have some happy times because you met your husband there, didn't you?
Oh, yes. Well, that is in my second book. Yes, I met my husband in Switzerland.
How did that happen?
Well, I couldn't study medicine anymore because we had no money, and the Swiss government gave me a grant to go to a commercial college. And when I finished, after 6 months, I took a job in a small hotel in Hergesville near Lucerne, and that's where I met my husband. But at the time when we met, it was only a short time. He went back and he told his parents, I met a girl in Switzerland I'm going to get married to. But he hadn't told me.
Oh, so he didn't actually propose to you before?
No.
It arrived?
No.
And surely the decision to move to England was it a hard one after being forced to move around and then finally returning home? Was
yes.
it another wrench to move to
yes,
another
course,
country?
Yes, actually. I came over to learn the language because I thought I will go into the hotel trade now, and but I must learn English because that is one of the stipulations when you're in the hotel trade. And I came as an au pair girl, not very far from where my husband lived. And of course, then he kept, or my future husband then, and he kept on coming to see me. And eventually, he did propose, so more or less, I think. And then it was hard to make a decision because I didn't know whether I wanted to move away again from my family. We had only just sort of settled down in Switzerland. But I did. I felt happier in England, actually, than I did in Switzerland. Switzerland had never had a war. And they didn't quite understand us coming back as emigrants with nothing.
So they didn't exactly welcome you with open arms?
No,
well,
they didn't really.
What problems did you have there?
You see, although I spoke German, I didn't speak the Swiss dialect.
So because you were a German speaker?
Yes. So as soon as I walked into the shop, they recognised me as an emigrant. I couldn't have been a pure Swiss person, although my father and grandfather were Swiss. And also, when we arrived, I never really forgiven them for that, because when we arrived, they put us into quarantine. We had to go into a camp, and I was locked in. Well, I'd never been locked in my life, but I was when I came back to Switzerland. Men and women were separated, even the children, and we all had to strip naked, and we had an examination. They were afraid we might bring a disease back. Well, I felt I was coming home to my home country, and I didn't forgive them for the treatment we had in quarantine. But after that, then they helped us. You know, they gave us some money to start again, to buy furniture and have a flat, and that gave me some 6 months to train, and they helped my brother and sister. My brother went in the army, actually, because in Switzerland you still have to go into the army at 18 and 19, so that actually occupied him for a year. And when he left, they gave him a grant to study engineering. So we had help after that, but the first arrival was a bit of a shock.
Oh, you lived through some really mad times. How do you think it's affected you as a person, looking back now?
I think that time, I've sometimes wondered whether that was a preparation for later on, because when I married, my eldest son had cerebral palsy. Mm. And
you're not
again.
A stranger to Sheffield, are you, for that
no.
reason?
No. When he was 14, he came up to Sheffield to have several operations. He was in the Rivlin Valley in King Edward VII's hospital for 6 months, and Mr. Sherrard had to set his feet and operate his hip so that he could walk straight. He doesn't walk perfect. He's still got a stick, but at least certain operations got him on his legs and able to walk, because otherwise I don't think he would have been able to walk.
Mm. You have had a very traumatic life, haven't you?
Yes, but don't we all have some kind of experiences, good and bad? And I think if you always look ahead, and I had a good husband who always backed me, you can do a lot of things. I mean, I did a lot for my son, because when he was 18 months old, they decided we would never walk or talk, and they wanted to put him into a home. And I knew he was intelligent. And you know, if somebody says to me, you can't do that, that just about starts me off. Mm-hmm. And when they told me that this was going to happen to my son, that he was would finish up for the rest of his life in the home, I thought, oh no. And I think I learned early in life to have courage, and I've always had courage. I don't want to pride myself, but I've always tried to do things, and I have always found people who helped me. I must give them credit. But you have to look, and you have to push, and you get it.
Well, what prompted you to write your story?
It was my two sons. You know, I never talked about my time as a refugee. I couldn't. It was absolutely terrible. It really was. Because I experienced too much in that refugee track, and then the frost and the cold and the hunger. But my children said, if I don't talk, I must write it, and if I write about it, they could read about it one day, even if I don't want them to read it straight away. But I let them read it, and that started it off. They said it was a story to be told, and I would tell the world what it was like in the East, because a lot of people don't know what happened in the East. They only know what happened in the West of Germany. And then it got published, and that was it. And then I got all the fan letters saying, what happened after you returned to Switzerland? And that's how the second book originates, because I had to tell people then what I did in Switzerland, and how I got married, and my other story.
And it's all rounded up to present day. I tell you what, one of the nicest things I found was the fashion show, because you actually passed a seamstress course.
Yes.
And your family are on the catwalk. Yes. In the clothes.
Yeah. Well, I did a 2-year full-time training course to become a teacher. And because of having to carry my child for so long, I ruined my back. Yeah. So I couldn't teach for a long time because of young children. You have to bend over furniture and so on. And I thought, if I specialise myself in something else, teaching the grown-ups, I specialised myself in needlework, and I learned Savile Row tailoring. I always remember that, Savile Row, because it's supposed to be... Yes, it's supposed to be the best. And I taught tailoring in Oxford, and we had these big fashion shows, and I introduced the gents tailoring. Well, I had to have a model, so I made suits for my husband and for my second son. And yes, in the book there are some photographs when they're on the catwalk, so to speak.
Helga Gerhardy, thanks very much for coming in and sharing your story.